So over these days of Lent, we're going to be looking, rather than just at the scriptures of the day, looking particularly at this book of Lamentations. It's an important work for us. So by way of a short introduction to the book.
The book of Lamentations, it's a unique book in the Old Testament that contains five poems from an anonymous author who survived and is now reflecting back on the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem and the destruction and the exile that followed. Remember the whole story from the book of 2 Kings. The fall of Jerusalem and the exile was the most horrendous catastrophe in Israel's history up to this point. So remember, God had promised Abraham the land. He'd given David victory to make Jerusalem Israel's capital. And from David came the royal line of kings. You had God's presence there in the temple, and that's where the priests maintained the rituals of Israel's worship. And after 500 years of all of this history, in the summer of 587 BC, the city fell to Babylon. It was all decimated and gone. And so the Book of Lamentations is a memorial to the pain and confusion of the Israelites that followed this destruction.
So to truly make sense of the whole of Jewish history, there are these two key moments that we need to be aware of. The exodus from Egypt, from slavery, into that place of freedom. Now we're fairly familiar with that. But the exile, this dark moment, the exodus was a moment of light, a moment of freedom, a moment of rescue. But the exile, the Jewish people realized, was a consequence of their sin and their failure, their inability to respond to God. So both of these are key moments, around 1200 BCE and then the year 587, that was the result of this two-year siege by the Babylonians onto the city of Jerusalem. So this book of Lamentations, in the Hebrew it's called by the first word of the book. This is always the case of the Old Testament books, just like papal documents are now called by the first words of the book. So it was in the days of Scripture. And the first word in Lamentations is this word ekah. It's this cry, this exclamation, this longing, this sense of trying to make sense of what on earth is happening. This city that God had promised would be the city of God, this place of God's dwelling, the place where the temple was, and it had all been destroyed. It was all gone. How lonely sits the city that once was full of people. That's the opening line. And you see it again in chapter 2 and again in chapter 4. So this whole sense of ekah, it's certainly a thoroughly depressing book. You know, you don't want to read it if you're already feeling sad and lonely and dark. It won't help you to be lifted out of that place. And so it's a key book. There's not even any redemption. God is completely silent across the pages of the book. There's no voices of God, no words of God. Some lovely lines, yes, but it's not as if we get, you know, the shining light who's able to come in, even like the book of Job, which is, again, a thoroughly depressing book for the first 35 chapters. But then at least God gets to speak, and God allows Job in the midst of the whirlwind to speak this truth into this situation. But not here. No redeeming words, no light of resurrection, no light of joy, no light of grace at the end. So it's probably for that reason that it's rarely used in the liturgy. It's used in the Jewish liturgy to commemorate the fall and the destruction of Jerusalem. It has been used in the Catholic liturgy. It certainly influences part of the Holy Week liturgy, and it's used during those 3 days of Tenebrae that we rarely ever do anymore. But this whole sense of this thoroughly depressing book, why do we need to read a book like this? And part of the reason is that we live in this culture that's always denying the very essence of anything that's bad or that's depressing. For example, we spent over $1 billion last year on cosmetic surgery, and you mightn't think that that's necessarily all that much money, but in fact, per capita, we spend 40% more than the Americans do. And whenever you spend more on something than the Americans do, it's usually a pretty bad sign of something that's a little bit wrong in our world. Another example is we spent $22 billion last year on cosmetic and beauty products. I didn't contribute much to that spend at all, I have to say. In fact, many households spend more on beauty products than they do on electricity, on energy bills. And so there's this strange kind of situation. Queenslanders spend the most in Australia. Tasmanians spend the least. You can work out why that might be the case. This whole sense of lamenting, when we see terrible, heinous situations and crimes, the typical response to atrocities for trauma is to banish it from our consciousness. And the media cycle know that. You know, they will present this natural disaster to us, but within a day or two, it will completely disappear from the coverage. We often won't even hear the end result of it. We won't know how many people died in the Grenfell Tower. We don't know, you know, the final death tally, because we're sick of it. We want to move on to something else, another atrocity, or something that will lift us. So we don't want to think about these things. Some things are just too terrible to allow them to come to consciousness or to be uttered aloud. And Judith Herman, who that quote is from one of her books, she says, you know, that's the very definition of this word, unspeakable. We just don't want to talk about it. We don't want to think about it at all. Lamentations helps us to confront some of that. Laments expose us to the dangerous truths that we're inclined to suppress. So laments help us, you know, in those days of darkness, in those days when things are just falling apart and we don't know where to turn or where to look, the Book of Lamentations can be a guiding light or a model for us to say it's okay to lament, it's okay to complain and carry on. It's not just in the Book of Lamentations, we also see it in the Book of Psalms. There's at least 10 different psalms that are classically laments, and lots of the prophetic writings are also full of laments. Lamentations is unique in the whole book, and only the book is just lament after lament. So laments are a way for us to protest, a way for us to process emotion, or to voice the confusion that we might be feeling at the moment. And so it's just allows us, gives us permission. And often in our society, we don't give permission for people to mourn, to grieve. Just look at the way that we celebrate funerals. You know, everyone is very contained and controlled and in charge of their emotions. But you go to like a Middle Eastern country and you see all of the wailing and the carry-on and the people that are often professional mourners and grievers who lament in order to give permission to that community, to the person who has just lost their spouse or their partner, to grieve, you know, openly, to weep, because that's the healthy way, not this controlling way that we in the West want to do. One of the things that we see, one of the characteristics of this book is just the way that it's structured. So this is from the Voice Bible in the very first chapter, the first of the poems. The first line starts, "Ah, lonely is this city that once bustled with life. Cheer is empty like a widow. She's abandoned and oh, so lonely." And then verse 2, "Bawling, she weeps." Verse 3, "Carried off to a foreign place." Verse 4, "Despair permeates." Verse 5, "The enemies of Jerusalem." This translation attempts to capture something of the original, the structure in terms of the alphabetical nature of this poem, that it attempts to open each line with the next letter of the alphabet. So what we see in this is that there are these five chapters. The first verse, or the first chapter, the first poem, has 22 verses of three lines each. The second chapter, 22 verses of three lines each. The third chapter, 66 verses of one line each. The fourth chapter, 22 verses of two lines each. And the fifth chapter, 22 verses of one line each. And the verses, chapters 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, are all alphabetical poems or acrostic poems, which simply means that, yeah, as I said, each letter, each verse begins with the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. If you got one of the handouts, so you'll see that each of the verses has in the opening brackets there the next word of the next letter of the Hebrew alphabet. So Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Daleth, and so on through the alphabet. And then in some ways, this whole sense of grief and chaos that we experience, there's no way to describe it. And so perhaps the author was simply wanting to say, look, I'm trying my best to go from A to Z, or in this case, from Aleph to Tor, of this whole sense of this emotional of chaos and disorder and grief. And so it's this attempt to bring this ordered and linear structure to something that is just so disordered and confused, this pain and this grief that is unable to be experienced and felt in any other way. So let's look at the first chapter. So there are the two main speakers in the chapter. The narrator, who's simply giving the very offhanded description of what's happening, describing all of the sin, describing all of the dysfunction, describing all the ways that the city has fallen and fallen into a heap. And then the city itself gets to respond. Well, she doesn't really, but she's personified as a woman, this daughter Zion, who the narrator describes as a widow, someone who's lost it all. And so she is this lamenting and letting forth her grief at this terrible situation. So the narrator speaks of the city, once so beautiful, once so glorious, once so clothed in goodness and splendor, and now brought low, just this widow, destitute and hopeless. So she weeps bitterly because there doesn't seem to be anyone to comfort her. And he contrasts her former glory to her current lowliness. So let's listen to one of the verses from the TNIV version.
Her filthiness clung to her skirts. She did not consider her future. Her fall was astounding. There was none to comfort her.
Look, Lord, on my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed.
So until this point, the narrator is just pouring out all of this blame, all of this condemnation, all of this sense to the city, telling the city, it's all your fault. All that has happened, all of this destruction, all of this chaos, all of the people that have died, all of the people that have been taken into captivity, into exile in Babylon, it's all your fault because you were so disgusting, you were so filthy, you were so terrible. The filthiness clings to her skirts, probably about her menstrual fluids. Just this, she hasn't even bothered to clean herself up after this and all of this. But all that she wants is for God to look, to see all of this destruction, all of this chaos. All that she wants is just someone to be able to hear her. Oh Lord, look at my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. And then the narrator just doesn't even seem to hear her interjection, and he continues leading into this.
All her people groan as they search for bread. They barter their treasures for food to keep themselves alive.
Then look, Lord, and consider, for I am despised. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look around and see, is any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord brought on me in the day of his fierce anger?
So you see that she cries out to God, look, Lord, and consider, for I am despised. But God seems to be silent. God doesn't seem to offer any answer. There's no prayers, there's no vision, there's no voices. Look, Lord, and see how worthless I have become. So what does she do? She finds someone else. She finds a passerby to see. What about you? Will you at least look at me? Will you at least see the degradation that I've now fallen into? Will you see all of the destruction that I have experienced? I mean, so often that's our cry, that's our need. When we've gone through this period of turmoil, you know, even as parents, as the children grow up and they're no longer as innocent and able to be bend to your will and do everything that you want them to do, and suddenly they're starting to be independent and they're moving away from home, there's a grief, there's a mourning that's associated with that. Or you've lost your job, or in the whole sense of that transition, that change that happens. Or your spouse, your wife or your husband has died, or one of your children, and this whole sense of the grief of dealing with that. Our first need is not simply for dogma or for solutions. We just want to hear, someone to hear our story. So the account is blunt, it's immediate, it's traumatic. It's an example of what they call a chaos story. The first need is not answers, but just a space within which someone will listen. And perhaps that's the lesson that we as church need to learn. to be that space, to be that place where we can sit with each other. Again, in the Jewish tradition of grieving, the first tradition is of sitting Shiva, that when someone has lost someone, that you don't go to that place and offer solutions. You don't go to say, oh, look, it's all going to get better. You'll get through this. No advice is given. The friends, the neighbors of the person who is grieving will simply go and sit in silence with that person. They don't have to come up with any answers, any words to say. We all find it so difficult to speak into that situation because all the words seem so empty. Instead, they just sit in silence. And it could be for days until the person who is grieving gives permission to the others to speak by first speaking themselves. And again, there's no pressure. But so often, all we need is that space, that place to be able to grieve and for someone to hear our laments. The Book of Lamentation provides an answer to that, provides a solution to that. It gives us permission to say, it's okay to ask this question, look and see my suffering. That the Book of Lamentations gives us that framework within which we can express our grief in those days of darkness.